Hello, and welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America, designed for people like you who are learning American English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz in Washington. Every day of the year on this program, we bring you news from and about the United States and the world. Because this program is produced for learners of American English, like you, we speak a little slower than normal, and we use words and phrases that are easy to understand. Listen to the program, then practice saying the words and sentences the way we do. It's a free and easy way to improve your American English skills every day of the year. This is what you will hear on today's program. In our weekly higher education report, correspondent Pete Musto will tell us about a recent government report on the spread of sexually transmitted diseases among young people in the United States, including college students. Then you will hear Words and Their Stories, one of our most popular programs. This week, Ana Mateo tells us about the long and interesting history of the word lobby. During the early years of the United States, lobbyists had a bad name. Some say they still do. And finally, we will present The Making of a Nation. Today, we will tell you about life in the United States after the end of World War II. So, you can see, as always, we have a lot for you today. So, let's get started. Here's higher education correspondent Pete Musto.
College is a time when many young people experiment and learn more about themselves. Some may have romantic relationships and even engage in sexual activity for the first time. But experimenting with sex has risks. Sex without a condom can lead to pregnancy and sexually transmitted diseases. In fact, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention released a report in October on the spread of STDs in the United States. The CDC is the main government agency dealing with public health in the U.S. The CDC report showed cases of gonorrhea in the U.S. increased by 13% between 2014 and 2015. Cases of syphilis rose by 19%, and the number of cases of chlamydia grew to 1.5 million, the highest level the CDC has ever recorded. The report showed the majority of cases of chlamydia and gonorrhea were among people age 15 to 24. Most college students in the U.S. are between 18 and 25 years old. Eloisa Yada is a medical researcher working on STD prevention for the CDC. Yada says throughout history, STDs have affected people between the ages of 15 and 24 more than any other group in the U.S. But she says the college environment does create unique risks. Yada notes that a student can come from a small community with a limited number of sexual partners to an area with a larger population. She also says the college experience can lead young people to engage in risky behavior.
These folks tend to be unmarried, have maybe more than one partner at a time, and college might be an area where things like binge drinking and drug use might play a larger role.
The CDC reported in April that the pregnancy rate among women age 15 to 19 in the U.S. reached an all-time low. Yada says this change is because more young people are using contraceptive methods such as the birth control pill. The pill is a type of medicine women must take every day to prevent pregnancies. But the pill does not prevent the spread of STDs. Yada says getting an STD has serious consequences. STDs can affect a woman's ability to have children and may put people at greater risk for the human immunodeficiency virus. Laura Lindberg, a research scientist with the Guttmacher Institute, says the rise in STD rates is not yet a major cause for concern. The Guttmacher Institute is a nonprofit organization that studies sexual health and policy in the U.S. Lindberg argues that a major reason the number of reported cases of STDs has gone up is because more people now have access to health care. People do not know they have an STD unless they get tested for STDs, she says. And most people do not go to the doctor because they believe they have an STD. Lindberg notes people most often get an STD test while they are at the doctor for another reason. She argues sexual activity among young people has not gone up in ways doctors can measure, and condom use has decreased only a little. So, Lindberg says, the increase in STDs shows only that more young people are getting tested. I'm Pete Musto.
Thanks, Pete. Now, here's Anna Mateo.
Join us now for Words and Their Stories, a program from VOA Learning English. Each week, we tell the story of words and expressions used in American English. Some of them are old, some are new. Together, they form the living and always changing language of the American people. In the United States, during an election, voters go to the polls to cast their votes. When deciding on which candidate to support, voters consider many things. They consider the issues a candidate supports. They also consider from whom the candidate receives money or campaign donations. And that brings us to our word for this Words and Their Stories. It's a political word, lobby. Lobbying is an attempt to influence a legislator's vote on a bill. Lobbying has been a legal activity since the earliest days of the United States. The First Amendment to the Constitution says that no law may prevent people from petitioning or requesting the government to change things the people feel are wrong. The right of the people to petition the government has led to lobbying. Lobbying is a type of free speech. English speakers have used the word lobby for almost 400 years. The lobby was the large room next to the House of Commons in the British Parliament. The lobby was a public area where private citizens could meet with legislators to make requests. So people who met in the lobby with legislators were called lobbyists. Besides politics, a lobby is also part of many large buildings. Many apartment buildings and hotels have lobbies. You can also meet your friends in the lobby of a theater or concert hall during the intermission of a performance. This, however, does not make you a lobbyist. During the early years of the United States, lobbyists had a bad name. There were many cases of lobbyists buying the votes of lawmakers. They were seen by the public as dishonest people who influenced legislation illegally for their own private gain. In later years, Congress and state legislatures passed laws to restrict dishonest lobbying activities. Lobbyists must register with the government, and they must follow many complex regulations. Legislators and the public began to recognize the value of the job done by honest lobbyists. There are many honest lobbyists who try to influence legislation. Lobbyists and lobby groups have an active part in making laws. They help inform Congress and the public about problems and issues. Lobbyists provide technical information about legislative proposals. And lobbyists let lawmakers know whom a bill would help and whom it would hurt. As the federal government has expanded, so has the number of special interest groups, industries, labor unions, professional organizations, citizens groups, and representatives of foreign interests. These special interest groups all lobby Congress. A lobbyist represents a group and tries to advance its interests. When a bill is proposed that affects that group, a lobbyist meets with the lawmakers to explain the group's position. There are so many lobbyists that almost every side of an issue is represented. Some experts say the number of registered lobbyists is decreasing. However, other experts don't agree. They claim the number of lobbyists actively lobbying the U.S. government is actually growing. However, to avoid the lobby registration system and regulations, these lobbyists have gone underground, or they do their lobbying out of public view. This does not help their public image. And that brings us to the end of this Words and Their Stories. I'm Anna Mateo.
Thanks, Anna. Now, we present The Making of a Nation. World War II finally ended in August 1945. Life in the United States began to return to normal. Soldiers began to come home and find jobs. Factories stopped producing war materials and began to produce goods for peacetime. At the same time, other changes began to take place in society. Many Americans were no longer satisfied with their old ways of life. They wanted something new and better. And many were now earning enough money to find that better life. Millions of Americans moved out of cities and small towns. They bought newly built homes in suburban communities outside busy cities. Today, we look at the growth of suburbs and other changes in the American population in the years after World War II.
And we'll have the living room right in here, and the kitchen right here, so we can see the children playing in the yard.
Yeah, the children. Children? Say, how many are you planning on? Not more than six, I hope. Maybe I better add a few more rooms back here at that.
A married couple in a marketing film for the home building industry. The United States counts its population every 10 years. The first census took place in 1790. At that time, the country had about 4 million people. 100 years later, in 1890, the population was 63 million. By 1950, there were more than 150 million people living in the United States. In the early years of America, the average mother had 8 to 10 children. Living conditions were hard. Many children died at an early age. Families needed a lot of help on the farm, so it was good to have many children. But over the years, birth rates fell. Families began to have fewer and fewer children. By 1900, the average woman had only 3 or 4 children. In 1936, during the Great Depression, the average American mother gave birth to only 2 children. Things changed after World War II. Suddenly, it seemed like every family started having babies. Parents were hopeful about the future. There were lots of jobs. People felt the need for a family and security after the long, difficult years of the war. From 1950 to 1960, the number of children between the ages of 5 and 14 increased by more than 10 million. The increase in births after the war produced what became known as the baby boom generation. An estimated 78 million Americans were born between 1946 and 1964. Many of the new parents moved to homes in the new suburbs built outside the urban environment of cities. Usually, a developer would buy land, maybe from a farmer, then clear it, level it, and build houses on it. Young families would buy the houses with money that they borrowed from local banks. Life was different in the suburbs, calmer, less crowded than life in the big city. There were all sorts of group activities. There were Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts, parent-teacher associations at school, outdoor cooking, where families gathered in someone's backyard to eat hamburgers hot off the grill. Historian William Manchester described life in the suburbs in this way. The new suburbs were free, open, and honestly friendly to anyone except black people, whose time had not yet come. Manchester wrote, families moving in found that their new friends were happy to help get them started. Children in the suburbs exchanged toys and clothing almost as though they were group property. When little Bobby outgrew his clothes, his mother gave them to little Billy across the street. People felt safe enough to leave their doors unlocked. Parents did everything they could to make life good for their children. Between 1950 and 1960, the number of boys playing on Little League baseball teams increased from less than 1 million to almost 6 million. The number of Girl Scouts increased by 2 million. Bicycle sales doubled. And it wasn't just two-wheeled transportation that experienced a boost.
The USA in your Chevrolet. America's asking you to call. Drive your Chevrolet through the USA. America's the greatest land of all. On a highway or a road along a levee, performance is sweeter, nothing can beat her. Life is completer in a Chevy. So make a date today to see the USA. See it in your Chevrolet.
U.S. new car production was stopped during World War II to allow those factories to produce airplanes, tanks, and other military vehicles for the war effort. With the prosperity of peacetime, many Americans visited auto dealerships for the first time in years to replace that tired family car with something more up-to-date, even luxurious. For many years, popular singer Dinah Shore invited optimistic post-war Americans to take to the highway and see their country in a Chevrolet.
And see in your
post-war prosperity also led Americans to replace outdated home appliances, buy a new refrigerator or a television set.
Come closer, sweetheart. Well, say, I don't think that's fair, because we can't get closer.
Oh, but you could. If you had one of the new Westinghouse television sets with the exclusive electronic magnifier that gives you a big close-up image whenever you want it. All you do is turn the electronic magnifier knob, and there, you get the heart of the picture. And see, I'm close enough to say, hello, good looking.
Actress Betty Furness was commercial spokeswoman for Westinghouse.
And every Sunday night, General Electric brings you the finest motion picture stars on TV. The great names in comedy, in mystery, in romance. Every week a star, all summer long, on the General Electric Theater.
Over at competitor General Electric, actor Ronald Reagan, later the 40th President of the United States and often referred to as the Great Communicator, was for many years an effective television commercial spokesman every week on the GE Theater. Parents also tried to improve their children's education. In 1960, parents bought almost three times as many educational books as they did 10 years before. Parents also bought millions of dollars worth of pianos, violins, and other musical instruments for their children. It was true that the average number of children per family was increasing, but the total population of the United States did not increase as much during this period as one might have expected. The reason for this was that fewer immigrants were coming to the United States. In fact, the number of immigrants had been dropping for many years. In 1910, 11 immigrants were coming to America for every 1,000 Americans already living here. By 1950, less than 2 immigrants were coming for every 1,000 Americans. Where immigrants were coming from also changed. In the past, most came from Northern and Western Europe. But now, growing numbers of people came to the United States from Southern and Eastern Europe and from Latin America and Asia. Other changes in the United States population were also taking place. In the 1950s, most Americans still lived in the Eastern, Central, and southern parts of the country. But growing numbers moved west. The population of the western states increased by almost 40% during the 1950s. Remember we said the United States population gets counted every 10 years? One reason is because populations are used to decide how many members each state will have in the House of Representatives. Population changes can mean changes in the political influence of individual states in Congress.
Another population change after World War II was in life expectancy. An American born in the early 1900s could only expect to live about 47 years. By the 1950s, however, most Americans could expect to live well past their 60th birthday. Life expectancy continued to increase with improvements in living conditions and medical care. The United States was a changing country, a nation on the move after World War II. Tomorrow, we look at political events that shaped the post-war period, including the shocking news of the death of Franklin Roosevelt, the longest-serving president in American history. It was 1945, and the United States was still at war. Roosevelt had led the nation since early 1933. He was the only president many young Americans had ever known. Who would lead them now? All eyes turn to Harry Truman. A reminder, we now bring you The Making of a Nation on Sundays and Mondays on this program. This Making of a Nation program was written by David Jarmul. It was presented and produced by Steve Ember, and we thank them both. You can find the entire Making of a Nation series online with transcripts, MP3s, and images at learningenglish.voanews.com. While you are visiting our website, you can also read and listen to longer versions of the stories that you have just heard on this program. You can also read, listen to, and download our other programs. And you will find captioned videos and lessons to test your American English skills. We'd like to hear from you. Send us an email. Our address is learningenglish@voanews.com. You can also send us a message through our website. Please know that however you reach us, we do read every message you send. You can follow us on Facebook, LinkedIn, iTunes, Twitter, and on our YouTube channel, all at VOA Learning English. And be sure to listen to VOA World News at the beginning of every hour, Universal Time, every day of the year. Well, that's our program for today. We hope it has informed and entertained you and has helped you learn everyday American English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz, reporting from Washington. For all of us here at VOA Learning English, thanks for spending some time with us today. I hope you'll join us tomorrow for another Learning English program from The Voice of America.